appreciate the prayer that's gone before. This morning, if the Lord would bless me, I'd like to look to one of the kings of Israel, and his name is Hezekiah. And there are many chapters in the Bible that are devoted to King Hezekiah. Many kings, there's not a whole lot written about. There's just a few verses or maybe one chapter, and that's about all you find about some of the kings of Israel. But there's an inordinate amount of space in the scriptures given to the life of King Hezekiah. In fact, you can start in 2 Kings chapter 18, and you'll find there about three or four chapters devoted to his life. You can look to 2 Chronicles chapter 29, and there you'll find, again, three or four chapters devoted to his life. And then if you go into the book of Isaiah, because Isaiah was the prophet of the Lord that lived during the life of Hezekiah. So if you look to Isaiah and begin in chapter 36 and you go through chapter 39, those four chapters are devoted to the life of Hezekiah. And you'll see as you look in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles and Isaiah that it essentially tells the same story, but there are focuses on certain areas. So 2 Kings would focus on a different part of his life than Chronicles would, and Isaiah would focus on a different area than some of the others. And so this morning I'm not going to go through and flip back and forth between those, but I've given you those so that if you want more information or more specific citations to some of the things I hope to bring forward, you can go home and you can read more about Hezekiah. But you might be saying, and I've mentioned this before, Brother Nathan, why do we look back at the Old Testament? Why do we have to look back and read some of these stories that are found in the Old Testament? And I believe just as much today as I've ever believed that the things that were written in the Old Testament can be very profitable for the people of God today. The Apostle Paul said that the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning. So there are many things, many theological lessons, and many practical lessons for the people of God to be found in the Old Testament stories. And Hezekiah is no exception to that. And so whether you start in 2 Kings or 2 Chronicles or Isaiah, you're going to soon find out that Hezekiah was a pretty young king. He started ruling at the age of 25. That's a pretty young person to be ruling over the most powerful nation on the earth. So he was 25 years old when he started his reign, and he was going to have one of the longest reigns in the history of Israel. He would reign for a period of 29 years on the throne. And Hezekiah is a great lesson for us, I believe, as one who had faith in the Lord, trust in the Lord, if you will. He was one that came from perhaps one of the most wicked kings. His father was a very wicked king, and his son Manasseh was one of the most wicked kings that Israel ever had. So sandwiched between these two wicked kings and his lineage is Hezekiah, one that did right in the sight of the Lord, one that trusted in the Lord, clave to the Lord, one that the Lord was with and prospered him greatly in everything that he did. But as I was looking at the life of Hezekiah, it became interesting to me that he, again, came from a very wicked king as his father, but his mother was the daughter of Zechariah. And no doubt his mother is one of the great reasons why he was a godly man in his life. His mother had great influence upon him despite his father. And so I think just in passing that that's a wonderful illustration as to how influential a mother can be and should be in the life of her children. Not to say that the father is not important, but the mother should also be a very godly example for her children. And that's exactly what happened here in the life of Hezekiah. As you read again in Hezekiah, and you begin again 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, or Isaiah, you're going to find out, as I said, that he was one that did right in the sight of God. Now again, that's something noteworthy because he uses the right kind of measuring stick, if you will. You know, a lot of people want to do what's right in the eyes of man. They want to make men happy. They want to make their parents happy. They want to make their friends happy, whatever the case may be. Hezekiah didn't care anything about that. He didn't care about going against all the things his father had done. He didn't care about making enemies in the kingdom that he was ruling. He was principally concerned with doing right in the sight of God. And again, that should be our measuring stick today. It doesn't matter what everybody else is doing. The only measuring stick we should have in our life is what saith the Lord, and going after the commandments of God. And that, again, was something that Hezekiah is a great lesson for us today. And so now Hezekiah, at the age of 25, he's taken over the kingdom. And we read that in the first month of the first year, he began to repair the house of God. See, his wicked father that had been king before him, he cared nothing for the house of God. He destroyed the house of God. He just laid it to waste, if you will. He had taken the gold from the house of God off of its doors. There was no priority whatsoever in Hezekiah's father's reign for the house of God. But now in the first month of the first year, Hezekiah is going to fix all that. And he's now starting to put an emphasis again back on the house of God. You know, I think that's a wonderful lesson for us, isn't it? That we should be kind of enthusiastic about the house of God like Hezekiah was. He didn't waste any time. He just jumped right in and said, this is how it's going to be. We're going to put emphasis again on the things of the Lord. And so it should be with us in our life. He was very much following the lineage of David, if you will, and the enthusiasm that David had for the house of God. Remember what David said? He said, that one thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. That was something that David had as a great priority. He would write in the Psalms that he would rather have his tongue cleave to the roof of his mouth than his right hand forget her cunning. He would just, again, place a great priority on the house of God, and so should it be with us in our lives, that we place a great enthusiasm and priority there. And he didn't waste any time. You know, a lot of people, they're saying, well, I want to, you know, finish strong. I want to end up in the right place. Well, sometimes where you end up is about how you start. If you don't start out right, sometimes you're not going to end up right. But Hezekiah, he wanted to end strong, and he started strong. The first month of the first year, he began to correct some of the grievous and blasphemous errors of his father's reign. And again, putting an emphasis back on the house of God. And so Hezekiah, he has in his vision, he has on his radar, if you will, a revival for the people of Israel. That's what he's very concerned about. He wants to see a spiritual revival in Israel. And so then he calls the people together, and now he's going to tell them what they need to have for this revival. You know, it's one thing to simply say, well, I want a revival. It's one thing to sometimes, as we sing the songs about revival, and I love those songs, and I'm not condemning those songs. We should pray for revival and sing those great songs and ask the Lord for revival. But sometimes, as Hezekiah will show us, sometimes you got to have a little action involved if you want a revival. And so he says, here's the formula. Here's what we're going to do. If you want a revival, you need to sanctify yourselves, sanctify the house of God, and clear out and put out from among you the filthiness that's in the house of God. Now notice that. He says, sanctify yourselves. You know, somebody says, I want a revival in the house of God. Well, it begins right here. It begins with yourself. You know, some people, they have the idea that maybe the revival would start with pointing out the faults in others and saying, well, maybe you need to get things right and we'd have a great revival. Or maybe they say, well, everything's just fine. Maybe we need to go out in the neighborhood and put door hangers on the doors and go visit apartment complexes and put ads in the newspapers and do all this so that we can have a great revival. No, that's not what Hezekiah is saying. He's saying, look at yourselves. Look deep into yourselves and sanctify yourselves again to the Lord. That is, again, setting your body apart, setting your life apart, so that everything you do is for the honor and glory of God. Look at yourselves first. And then after you've looked at yourselves, look next to the house of God. Make sure that you're holding that in your mind as a separate and holy place, and then clean out the filthiness that's there. And he's showing probably there that there's certainly not to be this attitude that everything's acceptable in the house of God, that anything and everything and anything is permissible, that it's all just hunky-dory, do whatever you want in the house of God. No, he's beginning to set order and saying, no, some things aren't proper. That filthiness of my father, it needs to be gone. It needs to get out of here. It has no place in the house of God. So he has called the people together, and He's given to them this formula, if you will, for a revival. And the interesting thing is, after he's told them this, they respond just like he told them. They arise and they begin to do the things that he told them to do. So there was a response to the message. And that's something that's obviously needful. That's something that I sometimes worry about and myself. And I wonder sometimes to myself, well, am I doing any good? Is there any response to the messages? But that's something that's needful. If there's going to be a revival, there's got to be a response to the message. And so they arise and they respond and they carry out this work of doing all the things that Hezekiah had given to them to do. They carry this out in a very short period. They weren't wasting any time. In 8 days, they got all of that accomplished that he wanted them to accomplish. Then, having done all that, he takes things one step further and he says, okay, now that you've sanctified yourselves, you've sanctified the house of the God, or house of God, you've put out the filthiness thereof, now we need to go back to kind of the basics, if you will, and remember some of the things that the Lord has done for us and some of the remembrances that he gave to us, namely the Passover. At this point in the nation of Israel, they had forsaken the feast of the Passover. Now you remember the Passover and how that was given to Moses and the children of Israel as they were fleeing from Egypt. That was supposed to be something that they would continuously keep every year for their lives. It was something that they were supposed to keep to remind them about the graciousness and the mercy of God and how he delivered them and how he and he only delivered them. It was to be a great remembrance to them. But they had forsaken it. They had let it go. They just put even that most sacred and most basic remembrance of God to the side. And it's no wonder that they're in the shape that they're in. A lot of people, they say, well, I don't know why our country's in the way it's in. I don't know why our church is the way it's in. It's because we have no remembrances of God. We've put everything to the side. Everything he's told us to do, we're saying, no, forget it. We're not going to go after that. We're not going to have any remembrances. We don't want anything to remind us about God. That's where these people were. They were in this awful shape because they had pushed God simply out of the way and forsaken, even again, the most basic reminders and remembrances of him. And so, of course, that's, again, one of the most bedrock and fundamental purposes of the ministry, isn't it? To put the Lord's people in remembrance. In fact, Paul wrote to Timothy and he said, you'll be a good minister if you put them in remembrance. And so that's something that we should strive to do as ministers. But so he's now said, now we're going to keep this feast of the Passover. We're going to bring it back. We're going to have this remembrance of how the Lord and the Lord alone has delivered us in times past. And so they then begin to have this worship service, if you will. Now again, we're just hitting the highlights here. Again, there's 3 or 4 chapters in Kings, there's 3 or 4 chapters in Chronicles, and there's 3 or 4 in Isaiah. So we're just hitting the highlights this morning. So go home and see where these highlights are coming from and do some more study on your own. But they're having this worship service and bringing back the feast of the Passover. And this was a worship service, as we find, that they hadn't seen the likes of for years. It had been years and years and years. It had been a long time since the people had felt this way in the house of God. They hadn't had a worship service like this since the days of Solomon. It had been decades since they had seen anything like this. And it talks there about the joy that they had in the house of God. Now, again, that ought to be something that we strive for. When we come into the house of God and we try to engage in the worship service, we ought to have a sense of joy within ourselves, not pleasure. Pleasure is something that's associated with men, something that's associated with the sin nature of man. But I'm talking about spiritual joy in the house of God. That ought to be something that we're concerned with. That ought to be our response, hopefully, to the worship service, that we can walk out the doors and say, it's been a joyful time in the house of God. That's how these people were. They walked out of the temple saying, oh my goodness, we haven't had a meeting like that in years. That's how we ought to feel, I believe, having this great joy in worship. Not just joy, though. They had a great response to the worship service. Remember, I talked earlier about the response they had to the message of Hezekiah and how that response is important. Here we see another response that they had. When they come out of the temple and they say, "We haven't had a joyful time like this in the house of the Lord for decades," what do? They then go into the high places and they begin to tear down the idols that they had set up. They then began to tear down the heathen gods that they had worshipped. All of this idolatry they didn't want anything to do with anymore, because they had been in the house of the Lord. They had heard the glorious news of the Lord. And they said, "We don't want this anymore. Let's get rid of all these idols." So they go out and they tear down the high places. Interestingly enough, they also tear down the idol that they had set up for the brazen serpent that the Lord had given Moses. You remember the brazen serpent that the Lord had given? That was a wonderful blessing to the children of God, that brazen serpent was. But they had set it up as an idol. You know, that tells me that even some of the most godly blessings, some of the most wonderful blessings you can have in your lives, you can make an idol out of. And we have to be very careful about that. Spouses are a wonderful blessing, but sometimes we can set them up as idols. Our jobs are a wonderful blessing, but sometimes we can make idols out of our jobs and out of our careers. Our children are wonderful blessings, but sometimes we can make idols out of them. And so we have to be very careful. Here, this wonderful blessing that the Lord had given with the brazen serpent, they had spent decades in idolatry worshiping. But now, they've had this joyful time in the house of the Lord, and they said, "No more. We don't want any part with that anymore. We want to worship only the true and living God." And so, then we'll flip then to 2 Kings chapter 18. Most of that had come from Chronicles. So now if I have my chronology right, in 2 Kings and 18, we begin to find out more about Hezekiah. There we find out that he was one that trusted in the Lord, and that he clave to the Lord, and that the Lord was with him. Now notice that. He trusted in the Lord. He's one that trusted in the Lord, I believe, with his whole heart. He's one that clave to the Lord. That is, he drew himself near to the Lord, and the Lord was with him and prospered him in everything that he did. Notice the pattern there. You say, "Brother Nathan, I feel far from the Lord sometimes. I feel like the Lord just isn't with me. I just don't feel his presence like I felt in the past." Well, let me ask you a question, dear friends. Have you ever felt like that? If you've ever felt like that, in those times, ask yourself the question, am I trying to cleave to him? That's what Hezekiah is doing. He's cleaving to the Lord, and the Lord in return then is cleaving to him. You know what James says? James says, "Draw nigh unto the Lord, and the Lord will draw nigh unto you." That's the pattern right there. You say, "Why is the Lord forsaking me? I just don't feel the Lord." How much time are you devoting to spending with the Lord? How much effort are you putting in to spending time in prayer, to reading his word, to spending very quality time, I guess I can say that, spending quality time with the Lord? Hezekiah is setting out that pattern here. He's saying, "I'm cleaving to the Lord," or, "I am one that cleaves to the Lord, and the Lord's cleaving to me, and he's prospering me." You say, "Brother Nathan, I just don't understand. The Lord seems far from me. It seems like I just spin my wheels and everything. It just seems like I'm not being blessed like I used to be blessed. I'm not prospering like I used to prosper." Well, again, maybe that's because you're not cleaving to the Lord. I got to say, I'm guilty of that right here. I know I'm looking at some, and I don't mean to necessarily direct this at anybody except me this morning. I need to cleave to the Lord more so that we can have that fellowship and I can feel his presence in my life, and that I might be prospered, not in a materialistic way, but in a spiritual way be prospered, that my studies be prospered, that my messages prosper. I need to cleave to the Lord more. And so he's one that's, again, he's setting things in order in the house of God. He's calling on people to support the Levites. The Levites were those that would tend to the house of God. They had no inheritance in the promised land. They had really no way of making any money or anything, or having any of earth's goods. They were supported by the other 11 tribes. As the Levites, they were those that tended strictly to the house of God. And so that was something that they had left off. And again, Hezekiah is showing great emphasis and priority on the house of God and making sure things are done properly and in order. And he's saying, in order for that to happen, you all, the other 11 tribes, you got to make sure you're doing what you're supposed to do and supporting the Levites so that they can devote their attention to the house of God. One expression is given of Hezekiah. It says that he did everything in the house of God with all his heart. He did everything in the house of God with all his heart. Let that just sink in, brothers and sisters. Are you doing everything in the house of God with all your heart? When you come to the house of God, actually, even before you get to the house of God, in your preparations for the house of God, are you putting in all your heart? Are you doing everything you can possibly do? Are you praying for the meeting beforehand? Are you praying for the preaching? Are you praying for the saints of God? Are you praying that the Lord would just rain down His presence upon you? Are you devoting time and just giving it all your heart and all your mind? Saying, Lord, just bless us like you've never blessed us before. Or do you wait until 10:59 or 11 o'clock to say that first prayer? Just wait until the person that's leading us in prayer is asking for the Lord to bless. Hopefully that's not the first prayer you've made during the week. And I don't think it is. I'm just telling you as a reminder. That ought not be the first prayer you offer for the blessing of God in the worship service. Hezekiah was one that did everything in the house of God with all his heart. He wasn't a half-hearted Christian, if I can say that this morning. There's no room for half-hearted Christians in the house of God. We all need to be committed to the Lord. And he was one, I believe, that prepared his heart and his mind. One that came, no doubt, in joyful singing to the Lord. One that was there and prepared to listen to the words of the Lord. One that didn't want to bring in any preconceived notions, but was setting himself aside completely that he might worship wholly the Lord. That's what we need to be doing. Just like Hezekiah there, doing everything in the house of God, whatever it is, doing everything with all your heart. Well, Hezekiah, as we'll come to find out, he was a godly man. He was one again that did right in the sight of the Lord, trusted in Him, clave to Him. The Lord prospered him. But a godly life is not a trouble-free life. Right? The Lord said, you're going to have tribulation. In fact, He said, you shall have tribulation. He said, you'll be hated of all men for my name's sake. He said, we're going to have trouble in this life. Well, Hezekiah is one that exemplifies that exactly. Being a godly man, yet he had a very troubling life. There was a time then when the king of Assyria is beginning to creep upon Jerusalem. And he's several miles outside of the walls of Jerusalem, but the king of Assyria has got his sights set on Jerusalem. He's wanting to take over that city and dethrone Hezekiah. And of course, one way that he's going to do this is he's going to send some of his leaders to Jerusalem. And they're going to stand outside of the walls and they're going to shout some of the most obscene and blasphemous words that you'd ever hear. So they're outside the walls there of Jerusalem, these men from the king of Assyria, and they're saying, don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Now remember, Hezekiah was one that trusted in the Lord, put all his faith in the Lord. They're saying, don't be swayed by Hezekiah. Don't trust in that God. Don't have faith in that God. Our king, the king of Assyria, our king is one that has gone from nation to nation to nation and overthrown them and their gods. They're saying, how's your God any different than all these other puny little gods that these people claim to believe in? He's one that's mightier than they, and certainly you're no exception to that. I mean, what a blasphemous message is that, coming to the nation of Israel, the people that worship the true and living God, and saying, your God is no different than all these other gods. Just like we overthrew them, we're going to overthrow you. Now you might as well just give up and let us have what we want. What a blasphemous message. And you know, that's exactly how the world thinks about our God. To the world, our God is no different than anything else. To the world, our God's no different than the God somebody might make out of baseball or sports or whatever the case may be. They just don't understand what they're talking about. They don't understand that we're worshiping again the true and living God. And so these people are coming and they're sharing this blasphemous message from the king of Assyria saying, don't be deceived by Hezekiah. Don't put your faith and your trust in this God. What's interesting is as they're standing there at the base of the wall, shouting this up to the men in Jerusalem, the people in Jerusalem hold their peace. They don't engage in a dialogue with these people. They don't engage in an argument with these people. You know, that was kind of interesting to me. I'm reading this, I'm thinking, oh man, if I'd been there, I'd probably not only be shouting some things back to them, but I'd probably also be shooting some arrows and trying to kill them right where they stood. But these men, they held their peace. They didn't engage in this back and forth with these heathen men. You know, I think there's perhaps a lesson in that sometimes we need to just hold our tongues. Sometimes, even though we might be tempted, sometimes we just need to hold our peace. Sometimes it's not needful or beneficial to engage in dialogue with certain individuals. And that's a discernment call that you're going to have to make as mature Christians. You know, the Lord said, don't cast your pearls before swine. You know, certainly in this case, that would be casting pearls before swine. But we're also told to be ready to answer and give an answer to any man that asks. And so there's some discernment in there. Paul would write to Titus and Timothy, and he would tell them to reject a heretic after a few admonitions. But he would also say to avoid them which cause divisions among you. You know, there are some people that we just don't need a dialogue with. There are some people we just don't need to spend our time and energy trying to convince them of certain things. And these people, I think, they understood that. They had some discernment. They said, no, in this case, we're not going to waste our time and energy with you. We're not going to engage in this dialogue with you. They held their peace. Hezekiah, this word has gotten to him about what the king of Assyria is doing. Now Hezekiah, he has some great wisdom of the Lord. He knows that the king of Assyria and his men are a few miles outside of Jerusalem at this point. And one of the things that he does is he diverts the water flow from outside the city to inside the city. You know, he had a great battle mind, if you will. He said, I'm not going to let the king of Assyria have our water. Why should we sustain his life? He's here to defeat us. So from what I'm told, you can go to Israel still to this day, Jerusalem to this day, and see how Hezekiah diverted the waters into Jerusalem rather than outside of the city. But he did that, again, with great wisdom that the Lord had given to him. But he then, in addition to that, he begins to encourage and comfort the people of Jerusalem. And he's telling them in a very courageous speech, I believe in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, he says there, to fear not the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him, for there be more with us than with him. Now, how in the world could Hezekiah say that? Hezekiah knew he was outnumbered, but yet he's saying to his people, we're in the majority here. The reason he could say that is because, as we later find out, for with him, that is the king of Assyria, is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord God, and he will fight our battles for us. That's the faith and the trust that Hezekiah had. That if the Lord's on my side, I'm in the majority. If the Lord's on my side, I don't have anything to worry about. Yeah, he may have 185,000 troops outside these walls, but I don't have anything to fear because the Lord is with me. What faith and trust. Oh, I wish I could have that faith and trust in the Lord to recognize whatever the circumstance of life is, if God's with me, I'm in the majority. Whether it's in situations of divisions in my life, whether it's something in the workplace, or even if it's something perhaps in this tiny little church, you know, people say, oh, there's just nothing there. There's just 15 or 16 of them if everybody shows up. Well, I believe we've got something special here. I believe we've got the true worship of the true and living God. And if the Lord's with us, guess what? That's all we need. We're in the majority. Those that drive by, they might say, oh, look at that church there on Nutman Avenue. They got 5 cars out there, 6 cars in the parking lot. Let's just keep on driving until we find the crowds. No, there may be an arm of flesh out there, but I believe here we've got the Lord. And the Lord's going to fight our battles for us. That's wonderful and comforting news that Hezekiah was trying to give the people of Jerusalem. But there's something else that Hezekiah did after he's trying to encourage the people. He then goes to the house of the Lord. Now notice this. In this day of trouble, in this day of adversity, where does Hezekiah go? Does he stand out on the wall with his weapons and say, "Come at me with your best shot"? No, he goes to the house of the Lord in his day of trouble. I'm telling you what, dear friends, that's the best place you can be in your day of trouble. I don't care what trouble it is, what circumstances of life you may be facing, the best place you can be in that time of trouble is in the house of the Lord. You know, some people have the exact opposite mentality. They say, "Oh, I just got all these things going wrong in my life. I just can't be in the house of the Lord. I've got trouble with health, and I'm just going through so much. I just can't be there." Now, of course, as I've said in the past, we understand sickness and people that physically cannot come to the house of the Lord. But some people, they get news perhaps of a health condition they have, and that just consumes them. And they say, "I just can't be there. I'm trying to work through all these health issues." I'm telling you what, there's no better place for you to be in those times than in the house of the Lord. Again, it doesn't matter what circumstances of life you may be facing. You may be facing issues with your job. Maybe your job's requiring you to work overtime and you're saying, "I'm just so tired. I can't get to the house of the Lord because I'm devoting all my time and energy to my job." The best place you can be in those times is in the house of the Lord. Maybe you say, "I'm having financial trouble and I'm trying to somehow, you know, send out resumes or do this or do that. I'm trying to come up with some way to keep my family afloat." The best thing you can do is come to the house of the Lord. Maybe you say, "My job requires me to travel so much. I'm just gone all during the week. And the only time I have to spend at home is on the weekends." You know, the very best place you can be at times like that is in the house of the Lord. It doesn't matter what circumstances you may face. In the day of adversity, be in the house of the Lord. And some, again, they have the exact opposite mentality. They say, "Well, I just can't be there." And you know, man is very good at finding an excuse to not be in the house of the Lord. You go over and read some of the parables of Christ, and you'll find some of the craziest excuses that people came up with. Some people said, "Well, I've bought this land. I've got to go look at it. I don't have time to follow after the Lord." Somebody else said, "Well, I've bought these oxen and I've got to go prove them." Like the oxen are really going to change in a day's time, right? They said, "I've got to go do that right now. I don't have any other time." Nope, I don't have time to be in the house of the Lord. One man even said, "I've taken a wife. I've married this lady. I don't have time for the house of the Lord." Well, first of all, maybe he should have considered her more before he married her. And second of all, I dare say if she loves him, they're going to still remain married even though he went to the house of the Lord. But that was the excuse that he came up with. Man is very good at finding an excuse to avoid the house of the Lord and saying, "I'm just in trouble. You don't understand. I'll get to it at a more convenient season." I've often thought about the man that told Christ, after Christ had bid him to follow after him, he said, "I just need a little more time. My father's passed away. I need to go bury my father, and then I'll catch up to you." I've often thought about that and how reasonable of an excuse that is in the mind of man. I mean, think about the most reasonable excuse you could have. "I just lost a loved one, dear Lord. I just lost a loved one. And, you know, let me just tend to this for a little bit of time, and then I'll be right there after you." And what did Christ say? Did he say, "Well, that's okay. I understand"? No, he said, "Let the dead bury their dead. You come after me." You know, the most reasonable excuse that man can think of, the Lord says is not an excuse at all. It doesn't matter what circumstance of life you're facing. It doesn't matter what adversity or trouble you're facing. I'm telling you right now this morning, based upon the authority of God, that you should be in the house of God. And that's the best place you can be in that time of trouble. It's going to take your mind off that trouble, if nothing more than just for a season. It's perhaps going to give you wisdom as to facing those troubles when you can hear the word of the Lord expounded upon. It's the best place you're going to find advice and counsel in this life. And so Hezekiah, again, is a wonderful example of that. In this day of adversity, this day of trouble, Lord, I've got 185,000 Assyrian troops outside my gates. What am I going to do? He went to the house of the Lord. And he didn't just go to the house of the Lord and that was it. No, we're told that he prayed to the Lord. And it actually uses this expression that he spread it before the Lord. You know what that means, to spread it before the Lord? That's an Old Testament expression. It means that he gave it completely over to the Lord. He was in the house of the Lord, and he just spread it before him. Just like you just spread out a bunch of papers. In fact, that might have been what he did, because he had actually gotten these letters from the king of Assyria that were relating to the threats of the Assyrian takeover. That might have been what he actually went and spread before the Lord. But he gave it completely to him. 110% said, Lord, it's in your hands. You take care of this. You're the one that's going to fight my battles. I've got a short arm of flesh out here. I don't have anything to match these people, but I've got you. And he just gave it to him completely. And of course, that's something, again, that we ought to do in our lives. When trouble and adversity comes, dear friends, give it to the Lord. And let the Lord handle the matter. Let him fight your battles for you. But in his prayer, Hezekiah, he has a mouthful of theology, and we can't get to all that this morning. But one of the main things that Hezekiah in his prayer is asserting is not just the power of the Lord, but also the sovereignty of the Lord. You know, these other men, they had come up from Assyria saying, your God's no different than these other gods of these nations that we've overthrown. Your God's nothing special. And Hezekiah then, he bows himself in prayer, spreading the trouble before the Lord. And he said, Lord, the one that sits between the cherubims, having in mind that great mercy seat, that place of sacrifice, I believe, again, perhaps even looking to the deity of Jesus Christ, he said, the one that sits between the cherubims, the one that rules the universe, the one that rules and reigns over every kingdom, you, I need your help. Deliver us out of the hand of the Assyrians. You know, that's a God I want to pray to. That's a God I want to acknowledge and have working in my life. I wouldn't have much comfort in this life if my God was not omnipotent and sovereign and ruling and reigning and having in his hand the heart of the kings, that he may turn it wherever so whithersoever he will. That's the one that Hezekiah is approaching, saying, Lord, deliver us out of the hands of the Assyrians. Well, the Lord, as we know, he's one that answers prayer. He's one that we should go to with our prayers, seeing that we have a great advocate with the Father, seeing that we have one that will give us the desires of our heart if we ask according to his will. And so he answers the prayer of Hezekiah, and we see the wonderful power displayed of the Lord. These 185,000 troops are killed like that. One angel takes out the 185,000. This isn't just a fictitious Bible story. This is a real event. Just understand this morning the power of the Lord. It made me realize, just in passing, I don't want anybody praying against me to the Lord, saying, Lord, that brother Nathan, he's really not treating me right. Maybe you ought to do something about him. This Lord, our God, he wiped out 185,000 troops. You think I'm any match for the Lord? I don't want anybody praying against me to the Lord. But the Lord, in his great power, takes out 185,000 troops. The king of Assyria is spared for a season. He runs back to his own country, or back towards his own country. And it's there in that place then that he's actually killed by his two sons. And then they begin to reign in his stead. But we see the great prayer of Hezekiah answered. And as I said, Hezekiah is not one that, having lived a godly life, was spared from trouble. He had the trouble here with the Assyrians. But Hezekiah was one that, in the later days of his life, he was lifted up with pride. And that's something, of course, that we all need to be careful of. He was blessed mightily of the Lord. Everything he did, the Lord prospered. But he was one in the later years, as I said, he just started to rely on himself a little bit more and a little bit less on the Lord. He was lifted up with pride. And that tells me that even the best of men are still men at best, right? We're all sinners. Hezekiah here, even though he's a man of great trust and faith, he's not a sinless man. He made mistakes in his life, and here was one of them, being lifted up in pride, The best of men are simply men at best. And the Lord then, He's going to send word to Hezekiah, or He does send word to Hezekiah, that his life's about to end. He's about to die. Of course, that's terrible news. I'd never want to be on the receiving end of that word that, Nathan, here's your expiration date. It's about to come to an end. I don't want that news. And Hezekiah, after he receives that word, then he turns his face to the wall and he again prays to the Lord. And wonderful examples of prayer in the life of Hezekiah, and how the righteous, effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Wonderful examples with Hezekiah. And so the Lord hears his prayer, and he tells Hezekiah, well, I tell you what, I'm going to extend your life by 15 years. Here he was on death's doorstep, and he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, I'm going to give you 15 more years. And you know, there's some lessons in that. Of course, I think one of the greatest lesson perhaps to be found there is this idea of absolute predestination doesn't hold much water. You know, there's a lot of people in the religious world that say, well, God predestined everything. Everything that you ever do was predestined by the Lord. The fact that I picked out this tie was set in stone before the foundation of the world. And that's what they believe. If a drop of rain hits the windshield, it was predestined to be that way before the foundation of the world. And, dear friends, that's just not true. And I think that's evident here with Hezekiah. Here he had a time to die. The Lord had said, you're going to die. But he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, well, I tell you what, I changed my mind. I'm going to give you 15 more years. You know, some that have this absolute predestination idea, they have the idea, too, that we have a time that's appointed to us to die. They say, well, we all have an hour. We all have an expiration date, if you will. We're all going to go at our time. That's what they say. We have a time. If somebody passes away, even untimely, they say, well, it was just his time. It was just her time to go. Now, that's not according to the Bible, dear friends. If that were so, then we would see Hezekiah dying and not be given 15 more years. In fact, Christ said that his time was then. I believe there was an appointed time for Christ to die. He died at just the right hour, in due time, that is, at just the right time. But he said, your hour's always. Our time of death, we don't know when it's going to be. It could come like that, or we might be like Hezekiah and be providentially spared for another 15 years. We just simply don't know. And so don't be swayed by this idea of absolute predestination. Certainly Hezekiah's life and his ending prayer there is a great lesson against that. But what wonderful lessons we have in faith and trust with Hezekiah. As I said, we just hit the highlights today. Go home and read all these several chapters, and I'm sure that you'll find many more wonderful lessons and how Hezekiah is an example of faith we should have and trust we should have in the Lord. May the Lord bless you. It's my prayer. Let's stand and sing a hymn today.